KaiserNetwork.org.
Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Ask the Experts, our regular interactive web show that provides in-depth discussion of current health policy issues and allows you to interact directly with the nation's top policy experts. The internet has transformed how we buy many everyday products. We comparison shop and make plane reservations using Expedia or Travelocity. We purchase books and music on Amazon.com and iTunes, and we can bid and buy just about anything on eBay. Yet in healthcare, not only do we not shop around ahead of time to compare prices, most of us can't even make sense of bills from doctors and hospitals after the fact. Some believe the nature of healthcare defies traditional market forces. We have relationships with particular doctors, and the moment at which we need care is hardly the time when we're likely to start shopping around. Others believe that's all about to change. With a growing movement towards high-deductible health plans and health savings accounts, many patients find themselves paying a bigger share of their healthcare expenses out of their own pockets. And as part of this effort to make the health system more consumer-driven, policymakers and health plans are looking to create more of a medical marketplace. To explore this drive to make healthcare prices more transparent, we're joined in the Kaiser Family Foundation's broadcast studios by an exceptional panel of experts. Chuck Cutler is the National Medical Director for Quality and Clinical Integration at Aetna and was previously the Chief Medical Officer for the American Association of Health Plans. Bob Dougherty is Senior Vice President for Government Affairs and Public Policy at the American College of Physicians, which represents 100,000 internists nationwide. And Jerry Anderson is a professor at Johns Hopkins University and a widely regarded expert in hospital pricing. You can reach our panel of experts in two ways. Email your questions to ask@kaisernetwork.org or call us here in the studio and ask your question on the air. You can phone toll-free at 1-888-KAISER-8. That's 1-888-524-7378. Thanks to all of you for joining us. And Chuck Cutler, let's start with you. Last year, Aetna launched a pilot program to disclose healthcare prices in Cincinnati, and you've recently announced an expansion of that program that will start shortly. Give us a sense of what's involved in this initiative.
Sure. As you said, Larry, the increase in the consumer sharing expense has made it more important for consumers to understand what their expenses are going to be. At this point, there are over 3 million people in those kinds of health plans. So we felt that it was important to try to provide people with information that would allow them to choose physicians and understand what the costs of healthcare were. But we wanted to do this in a way that was reasonably sensitive both to doctors and patients and to be understandable to patients. So our first step was to provide prices for services, about 30 different services for each specialty in the Cincinnati area.
And these are prices for individual physicians?
These are prices that we pay individual physicians. So one of the questions that we've gotten is this the usual and customary rate? Is this an average for the area? No, it's actually the individual prices specific to that physician. So if you're an Aetna member, you can go to the website and look up individual prices for physicians in the Cincinnati area and see for each type of visit what it is that it will cost you for those services.
And as you said, this started in Cincinnati, and it's being expanded to other communities next month?
That's right. In August, we plan to have the same information available for about 70,000 physicians nationally. We'll also be adding for the first time some information about efficiency and quality. One of the things which we've heard, which we expected to hear, was that people don't want to make decisions based on price alone. They'd like to have information about quality. And so we're attempting to provide some level of information about quality and efficiency for physicians as well. We already have a lot of information about quality for hospital care available on our website, but people are asking for more information about physicians.
And, I mean, you talked about the growth in consumer-driven or high-deductible health plans as being something of the impetus for this, but I think it's fair to say Aetna has gone further than other health plans in the marketplace. What drove you to see this as a competitive advantage?
Well, right now it's a competitive advantage. We actually had anticipated that a number of health plans would follow us. They haven't so far.
It's an advantage.
That's right. You know, I'm sure that there are some health plans that were concerned about how this might be perceived. We spent a lot of time talking with physicians in Cincinnati before we did this. What we didn't want to do was to have a worsening of relationships with doctors or to do something which might make their lives more difficult. And it turns out, actually, in talking to doctors, that they had a number of suggestions about the format and how we showed things that they thought would reduce some of the burden that they might get in terms of additional phone calls or questions because patients didn't understand the information. And they wanted it to be very clear what it was that we were describing. We didn't use CPT codes. We used a wording that was understandable to lay people, but physicians and their office managers had a number of suggestions about improvements we could make. So we tried to do this in a way that would maintain good relations with the physician community as well. But, you know, we think people make different decisions after they understand the cost. At Aetna, all of us now have one form of CDHP or other for our own health plan. And I can give you lots of anecdotes of things that occurred to Aetna staff once we understood what the costs of various services were. And making different choices.
So you actually seen people switch doctors as a result of?
Well, we haven't seen people switch doctors for, you know, for the Aetna employees. The kinds of things that occurred were more use of generic drugs and other things that one might expect with a CDHP. What we have seen is a use of the website. So we're getting between 600 and 1,000 hits on the website checking prices. You know, I don't think that for patients who have a relationship with a physician, that it's necessarily going to serve to motivate people to change physicians, unless there are very dramatic differences in cost. On the other hand, when one's choosing a physician or choosing to establish a relationship, it might well have an effect there.
And Bob Daugherty, you represent physicians. Mm-hmm. What's your view of the idea of health plans disclosing physician prices, first of all?
Well, I think the idea of transparency we support. I mean, I think if you look at it from your own personal perspective, all of us would like to know as much as we can about the physicians we see, that we trust for our health care, the hospitals we go to, and so forth. I think, though, that there is too much focus on price as a predictor of cost of care. That is, knowing what a physician charges, say, for a mid-level office visit, and most of my members are primary care doctors, the regular doctor that takes care of your daily problems, doesn't tell you when you go into the office whether you're going to need a mid-level visit or the highest level visit. Doesn't tell you whether you're going to need to be referred to a specialist for consultation. Doesn't tell you whether you're going to need laboratory testing. So price is very different than cost of care, and not that price isn't important, but price by itself, I don't think, gives you much in the way of accurate information to choose a healthcare professional. Similarly, unless you know what the insurance company has negotiated with the physician, what the price structure is for the insurance company, you really don't know what your out-of-pocket costs will be. Because it's really a comparison between what the insurer will allow and what the physician is allowed to charge. And that is subject to contracts. If you're a physician has a contract with, say, a dozen different health plans, each one will be very, very different in terms of its pricing structure, its allowables, how it determines what the market price is. And, you know, just interestingly, I just got an explanation of benefits, not from Aetna, for a family member just yesterday. And out of a $485 charge, $292 was not allowed. The reasons were, it said, see the note, and one was it exceeded the maximum price for that service. But there is no way for this particular health plan to know prospectively what the price is. So even if the provider is willing to disclose their fees, there is no way that I can tell in advance what they allow, never mind the methodology. How close is their market rates to really reflecting what the market charges for those services.
And Chuck, let me just clarify. In Aetna's case, you are actually disclosing the amount, the contracted rate between the health plan and the doctor.
Yes, that's right. There may be differences between plans in terms of what plans will pay. So if someone has an HMO plan, for example, when they go to see the physician, no matter what that doctor pays, they may only pay a copayment. So their out-of-pocket costs may still be only $10 or $20. On the other hand, if they have a PPO plan, the PPO plans will have different cost-sharing arrangements. Again, to Bob's point, you know, that may vary, but whether the base fees to which that coinsurance is applied is what's on the website. So what we're showing is only network physicians. So if you go out of network, I think some of Bob's issues
this
apply.
This is a network provider mm-hmm. in this case.
But if you're in network, and obviously we want to encourage people to stay in network, then what they will pay is whatever proportion of cost sharing they have on that specific fee.
And Bob, I think part of where you were going was there are many different ways to approach the issue of price transparency. Obviously a health plan disclosing the prices is one way. Requiring or asking doctors or hospitals to disclose their fees is another way. And some of what you talked about, I think, sort of points to the complications of of expecting doctors to disclose.
Well, it's not so much to doctors. I'm looking from the consumer point of view. What I would like to know, if I go out of network for specialty care, in this case, the example I was giving was an out of network healthcare professional, and if I'm going to shop around, I need to know not only what that healthcare professional is charging, to the extent that that's predictable, and that's not always predictable because you don't know what care you're going to need. I really need to know what the health plan is allowing, prospectively. And that information, by and large, is not available. Another part of the denial here was internal guidelines that they denied part of the service, which is appropriate that, you know, insurance companies do have the right and should be looking for medical appropriateness. And, yes, you can request those internal guidelines if I ask them and they'll send them to me for free. But, again, in terms of my out-of-pocket expenses, without having more information about what's going to be covered or not, it's very difficult to predict. So I guess what I'm saying is the idea of transparency has merit, particularly if we can develop very good quality indicators, because we believe that that is at least or more important than pricing, and some good cost of care measures that are developed in a transparent manner. By cost of care, some relationship between what resources are you using to deliver care that meet a certain quality threshold. Going that direction, I think, makes sense. But just the idea of posting prices, I think, is going to be very difficult, partly because there is not a single retail price that physicians charge for a service.
And how many a typical physician, how many health plans will a typical physician be?
Depends on the market. You know, there are some markets where you have a dominant insurer that may have, you know, 60, 70, 80% of the market, and then, of course, there's Medicare, which is huge, especially for internal medicine. But there's others where you've got a lot of different payers. But then even within the health plan, you know, take a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan, which tends to be dominant in many markets, they have different products. They got point-of-service plans, they got in-network, they got, you know, HMOs that you can't go out of network. All of those vary in terms of their pricing structure, what the rules are if you go out of network, and all those kind of things.
Jerry Anderson, let me bring you in and step back a little bit. Thinking about it, if one goal here is to moderate healthcare costs, is price the right thing or an important thing to be focusing on?
Well, certainly. I mean, it's either price or quantity, and we've, for the past 50 years almost, really focused almost exclusively on quantity. I mean, we have really tried to get the length of stay in the hospital down as much as we can to get as many people out of the hospital as we can. We've really focused almost all of our policy efforts, both in the public side and the private side, on the quantity side. And we haven't spent much energy on the price side. And as a result, our prices in the United States are much higher than prices in other countries. And we don't have much price competition out there for physicians and hospitals to really compete on.
And do you think if there were greater transparency in prices, would that help to drive down prices and in turn costs?
If it was true transparency, and as we've already heard, it's exceedingly difficult to do it right. But if it was done right and people actually paid those, yes, it would have an effect. People would, in fact, be many times outraged in how much they're, in fact, paying for certain types of health care. And it would get their attention if they knew about it. But it's hard to get that information in a digestible way that they can possibly understand.
And you and Professor Uwe Reinhardt at Princeton have talked about an idea to standardize pricing in healthcare without necessarily standardizing the level of prices, but standardizing the way that healthcare with hospitals or physicians are priced. Talk a little bit about how that might work.
Well, essentially, and this really is for the uninsured and a variety of people, there are so many different arrangements that insurers have and doctors have that there is no standard price. So one thing that you could consider is essentially say, we charge at X percent of what Medicare pays. So we essentially charge 125% of the Medicare rate or something. And that would give people one number to compare on. Right now you've got 30 different prices. Probably you don't have any one of those. Yeah, they're the most common ones, but a lot of things that you need you wouldn't have. It's really hard for somebody to look at 30 prices when many of those things they'll never have, and a lot of the things that aren't that price list, they will want to use. So you give them one number and say, a doctor says, I charge 20% more than what Medicare pays.
That's across the board. Any service I offer,
the board. And essentially, the Medicare RVRVS system is a fairly well understood one, and a lot of insurers base their payments on that. So it would be one number that people could understand.
Well, let's,
we got a lot of other things going on in our life.
Yeah, we certainly do. Well, we got a lot of questions from by email from people who at least are focused on this today. So let's move on to those. And one question from California, which follows up on the point Jerry was trying to make, which was what efforts can be made to help consumers understand the difference between charges and costs? The difference remains opaque to the average consumer. And Jerry, maybe stay with you in the hospital context, which you're certainly have expertise in. What is the difference between charge and cost?
Well, essentially, it's in California, where the caller is from, it's about 4-to-1. So the charges are 4 times greater than what are Medicare allowable costs, which are a little bit less than actual costs, but they're fairly close. So hospitals in California have marked up their prices about 4-to-1. In the typical hospital around the United States, it's about 3-to-1, and there are states like Wyoming and Maryland where the rate is only 2-to-1. So if you are looking at and trying to compare charges, it's essentially a fictitious number for most people. And it really has very little meaning.
And the charges are what's commonly publicly available now, at least in some states, right?
Yeah, on hospitals and increasingly on physicians. And essentially, it's an activity that the 45 million uninsured pay, but it's a rate that virtually no one else pays. And so it provides very little information. I mean, Aetna pays a much lower rate to hospitals than actual charges for most everything.
And Bob Daugherty, is that true among physicians as well, that there's a walk-in rate or a charge that's...
I mean, I think they try to have a retail fee, although I think nowadays it's less and less meaningful because Medicare is price controlled, so physicians have no discretion in Medicare other than whether they choose to be a participating physician, accepting the allowable is full, or they're non-participating, which still the rates are regulated. For the private sector, yeah, most of them, if you asked for your top 10 procedures, you know, what's your charge, they could give you a charge. But my point earlier is it doesn't tell you very much about what that means in terms of your cost to care or what the insurance company will allow or what your out-of-pocket expenses will be. Another major concern that we haven't discussed that I think is important is the idea of high deductible plans may introduce some price sensitivity, which could be a good thing. But there are studies that suggest that high deductible plans may also cause individuals to forego preventive care and primary care services. So it can actually be counterproductive in that sense. And then the other issue is I think price sensitivity works better when you're looking for an elective procedure. People use the example of LASIK, which there is price sensitivity. It's advertised all the time. But if you're in the last 3 months of life and we're spending most of the healthcare dollars and you're caught up in a system where you're sick and you're maybe first in the physician, then you're in the hospital, maybe you're in a hospice and you're bouncing around, I'm not sure that people are going to pay very much attention to price at that point of view, at that point in their lives. It's kind of, let's get through this, try to get the care we need, try to make those very difficult decisions the patient or family caregivers have to make at that point in time. And so if we think this is going to be a huge boon to lowering healthcare costs, I'm skeptical, because so many of those costs really happen at the end of life when you're making some very difficult, very emotional decisions. I don't think price and shopping around for price is something that's going to weigh heavily in people's minds at that point.
Chuck Cutler, the consumer-directed health plans are still relatively new, but is there any experience from the Aetna perspective that suggests how people do behave?
Yeah, you know, I think we are concerned about unintended consequences, as Bob mentioned, and we've actually been looking at the utilization of people in our consumer-directed plans, and fortunately we're not seeing the fear that you described with people using less preventive care services. Admittedly, it's early, and it's something that we're going to have to follow for a period of time. We also need to pay attention in how these are structured. So we've taken an active role with Treasury, arguing with them about the rules of what needs to be in the fund and what not. So we've actually worked with Treasury to get changes to allow first dollar coverage for some of those things which we think are necessary that shouldn't be in the fund. So medications for chronic illnesses like diabetes would be a good example. So we need to pay close attention to how they're structured. On the cost charge dilemma, you know, I think, you know, that may be some inside baseball for people who are in the plan or hospital business, but not so much for consumers because, you know, they don't care what it costs the hospital. They care what they're going to have to pay out of pocket. Where it becomes interesting is when we start looking at patterns of care and identify where the profits are, because there is no consistent relationship between cost and charges for a lot of services. So what we're finding is as we talk with physicians about improving the efficiency of their practice, that some of the things that are causing the inefficiencies may have a higher charge to cost ratio. That's where they're making some of their money. So we need to figure out other ways of paying so that it's financially viable for the physicians to do the things that add the most value. And that's something else that we're actively engaged in as well.
Well, I think what you've got is a very different thing between what Aetna has done and put on their website, at least for their members, essentially what it actually costs Aetna to provide care to somebody. Whereas if you go on the hospital websites and a number of the state associations, what you'll see is actual charges, which are four times what most insurers in California actually pay. So providing that information out there to the consumer provides them very little information. So, I mean, you are doing sort of the right thing. I think most of the hospital associations are really providing information, but it has relatively little value in terms of comparative shopping to the consumer.
I just want to pick up one comment, though, on deductibles, high deductible plans again. Patients who are near the end of life or patients with multiple chronic diseases have probably already used the deductible. So part of the question becomes, again, the social transparency, consumer-directed movement. How useful is any of this when you've already met your deductible because either you're at the end of life or you're a patient with congestive heart, diabetes, three or four medical conditions, you've already met your deductible.
Which means you're not paying
cost. There's really not any price sensitivity any longer because basically then you're within the insurance coverage, what they'll allow for those services, may be able to be denials based on medical necessity criteria. But it's a different world. And again, if you look at where the healthcare spending is going, patients with multiple chronic diseases, 66% of Medicare dollars go to patients with four or more chronic diseases. It's probably similar in the private sector. And then the end of life care, the amount of money we're spending. So I guess my point, my skepticism is not to say that informing patients isn't good. I think we all want that information. But the idea that it'll dramatically lower healthcare spending in this country, I'm a skeptic, partly because so much money we're spending is on very sick patients with multiple chronic diseases and people at the end of life.
And Chuck, is there a typical patient who you think is the best target for the transparency initiative? I mean, is it the person with a couple primary care visits a year, the chronically ill patient with diabetes or asthma or the person with a catastrophic, one-time catastrophic illness?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Bob. I don't think that consumer-directed health plans is the cure-all for controlling healthcare costs. I think we need to look at this in multiple ways, that the consumer-directed plans affect the initial spend that people have. So to the degree that encourages people to switch from brand name to generic drugs or to be more careful about their use of emergency rooms when they could visit their primary care physicians and so on, I think those are the kinds of changes that we'd like to see people make. And I think that can produce significant savings. In terms of whether it's going to affect catastrophic expense, I agree that I think once you hit your out-of-pocket maximum, it's not going to control catastrophic expenses. You know, we need to look at rational design for both the well people and the people when they start spending, and in more catastrophic situations. Again, to talk a little bit about what we're doing, we've looked at end-of-life care, and what we've seen is that people at the end of life have various barriers to doing things which would provide them with better care, with good palliative care, and do it in a way that doesn't penalize them. So we've actually also implemented an end-of-life care program that allows people to continue to get curative medicine. They don't have to give up hope. They don't have to give up their curative medicine, but they can continue to get palliative care at the end of life, because we think that's also a more rational approach. So one cure doesn't work here. We need to attack the various problems.
Well, maybe our next show we can turn to that.
Be happy to talk about this.
I just want to bring our audience. We have a caller on the line from Maine. Caller, please go ahead if you're still there.
Yes, hi. The gentleman from Aetna mentioned that the amount that's posted is the actual negotiated amount. I was curious about providers' willingness to disclose that, and really also Aetna's willingness, in as much as the parties to a negotiation might consider it proprietary information, and that if one physician knows that the physician down the street is going to be reimbursed at X, that physician might say, well, I'm not going to participate in your network unless you also pay me that much. And then also, as far as Aetna's willingness to disclose to other carriers in the Cincinnati area what they've negotiated. What are the concerns about this being proprietary information and undermining negotiating ability?
Well, thanks for your question. We got a number of email questions on this general topic as well. Chuck, first, did you talk to the doctors? I mean, did the doctors have to give their permission to have this disclosed, or is this simply Aetna's information that they're disclosing?
Well, it's Aetna's information that we're disclosing, but we did talk with the doctors, as I mentioned. And we did explain what it was that we were going to be doing. We showed them the formats. And I have to say that other than having some very constructive suggestions about how we display the information, there was very little resistance to sharing the information. As the caller mentions, I think some doctors saw this as a way of getting around antitrust concerns that the doctors have always faced. Having said that, since then, there's actually been very little or no movement for physicians to say, gee, I want to be paid as much as the next person. In fact, we've heard from some of the high outliers some concerns that, you know, that their prices appear to be so much higher than the rest, and is that going to have an effect on them? But realistically, we haven't seen any significant movement in terms of recontracting.
We had a similar question from an industry analyst in New York about concerns about competitive disadvantage. I mean, do you worry about, and the caller mentioned this as well, worry about disclosing this not just to your members but to your competitors, your health plan competitors?
Well, I mean, not that competitors couldn't get the information, but it's not on the Aetna.com website open to everyone. In order to get the information, either you have to be a participating provider or you have to be a member. So it's on one of two secure websites. If someone really wanted to, I'm sure they could collect the information in some way. So it's not that we're broadcasting the information. You know, secondly, we feel that there are a whole series of things which go into the total price of care. In addition to the cost of the office visit, it's all the medical management services. It's the other kinds of things that we offer as a health plan in terms of health plan value. In the end, what we thought was the risk of it having adverse consequences was less than the value of showing prices to people and being transparent. So one of the reasons why we did it in one market was to give it, you know, 3 to 6 months to be able to evaluate what the effects were, and we feel comfortable now in moving ahead in other parts of the country.
Sure.
I have a question for Chuck. and essentially what it is if we look at quality, and what we see is people don't really go to the high-quality providers because they don't always trust the measures, but the doctors that are perceived to be the low-quality doctors, they either leave that particular area or they do something differently. So the publishing of quality information has more of an effect on the doctors than it does a lot of time than on the patients. Now you said some of the very expensive doctors realize that they're very expensive. Are you seeing any evidence that they're going to start lowering their prices as a result of being identified as and knowing for the first time potentially that they are very expensive?
The short answer is no, but it's too early. But let me give you a different kind of example. One of the other things that we're doing simultaneously is having a selective network, which is in part based on efficiency, which is in part related to cost. There, we've had conversations with physicians who are apparently less efficient than their peers, and we have talked with them, if they're not included in the network, about the reasons why. What we're able to tell them frequently is reasonably specific. So they're not in the hospital if they're a surgeon, frequently because they use inpatient surgery facilities when they could be using outpatient surgery facilities, for example, or they order duplicative testing, or there are a series of reasons which are specific for that practice. When we start having those discussions, then doctors do say that they'll change their behavior. And in fact, we've had a very nice experiment with the Virginia Mason Clinic in Washington that's totally revised how they provide care for low back pain in order to be more efficient. So, you know, I think we're taking small steps in a number of different directions. And the key to me actually is engaging both consumers and physicians and looking at what they do to try to get that additional value.
Because from the economist's point of view, disclosing of the high-cost doctors, and if they feel any pressure to lower their prices, that would be a positive thing in terms of if they don't, however, if they don't change their behavior, then, you know, the disclosure of prices is just disclosing of prices.
Yeah, I want to go back to the issue of quality data, because what I said before, I think there's too much emphasis on price disclosure by itself as being a very good when you're introducing market forces or competition or informed consumer decision-making into healthcare, I do think providing quality data is extremely important. And the American College of Physicians is involved in a whole effort through a group called the Ambulatory Care Quality Alliance, which is a multi-stakeholder group that includes physicians, health plans, including Aetna, large employers, AARP, to develop good evidence-based quality measures, get them out there, and then actually develop models for reporting that information back to the public.
And are you comfortable having physician-specific quality measures?
Yes, we're very comfortable doing that, partly because the process is transparent itself. There are no black box measures. Everybody's at the table vetting these measures. And there's a pilot test going on in 6 sites around the country that the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality and AQA are doing to actually test ways of disclosing this information in a meaningful way to consumers. But my point is it's extremely important that the profession be at the table in developing the measures, that it be a multi-stakeholder process, and especially as we move to cost of care measures. For people to have any confidence in those measures, I think they're going to need to be developed in a transparent manner also, and not be black box measures that an insurance company has purchased, where the physicians can't and the consumer can't see what is the basis for that measure. The other point I wanted to make is there's a huge problem in this country with healthcare illiteracy, not just illiteracy, but healthcare illiteracy. People who can't even read the instructions in the back of an aspirin bottle. And we have a foundation that's working on a whole medication labeling project to deal with that. The challenge of trying to provide meaningful information about quality, cost of care, patient experience of care to patients that are medically illiterate is huge. And I think we shouldn't be overconfident that we know how to do that right now.
Let me ask you, we had a question by email from Kansas about this, about what is the best way to present this information to consumers? Is it on the Aetna? There's a demonstration on our website that links to an Aetna demonstration, which shows the actual dollar amounts for different kinds of visits and services. I'm assuming you all did some research about, is that the right way? Should it be $1 sign versus $3 signs?
Well, we did consumer research, and what we found was that the format that we're using was accessible to most people. I agree wholeheartedly with what Bob was saying about health literacy, which is a very serious issue, which affects a larger proportion of the population than I think most physicians realize. Having said that, I think there are limitations to what we could do with a website presentation that may always pose some challenges to people with limited literacy. So, you know, we need to take some steps in order to get the information out and essentially do the best that we can. I also agree that we'd love to have quality information on a physician-specific basis, and we do now have quality information for those physicians that have fulfilled the requirements for the performance recognition programs that NCQA runs. And that information is available on our website, and we're looking forward to the pilots with AQA and hope to have more information there as well. We don't, as a health plan, want to develop quality measures. All the quality measures which we use and measures that we'd like to display are ones that come from the profession, either the colleges or National Quality Forum or AHRQ or some other source. And ideally, what we've heard in the research since we put out the cost information is that what patients really want are the other quality information that Bob talked about. One, although this doesn't usually come out first, is the technical quality information. Usually what comes out first is the member experience with care information, which is even more difficult or more expensive to collect, but easier to understand by the consumer.
Bob, let me ask you, you represent internists, and would you imagine there are even bigger issues among some of the specialties in being able to assess quality on a physician-specific basis, and you know, in particular, being able to compensate for the fact that some providers may have a sicker than average population, and how does that show up in the quality measures?
Well, I think it's very complicated for internal medicine because internists take care of so many patients with multiple chronic diseases. And so most of the measures you have right now are specific to a disease condition, so you may have 3 or 4 measures for diabetes. What you don't have are good measures that deal with the patient who has diabetes, asthma, congestive heart failure, and so forth, and try to come up with a reasonable number of measures, but also not overloading the physician in terms of how many measures he or she may have to report on. We figured out that a typical internist might have to report on a dozen or so measures on a patient within a single encounter, depending on how many chronic diseases that patient has. So it's hugely challenging, and case mix does come up as a real concern that if you don't in some way, in the measure itself or in reporting on the measure to the consumer, take into account difference of case mix, you can create a conflict between the physician's ethical obligation to take care of the sickest patient and not wanting too many sick patients in their panel that will then hurt them in terms of how they look on a quality measure or maybe even more so on a cost of care measure.
Jerry, let me bring you in and talk about hospitals. We had a couple emails from Ohio and California again about what is the right price for hospitals and how do you compare prices for even if it's the real price or the real cost for two hospitals where one may be offering more, providing more charity care, which is then built into its cost structure, or doing more medical education, which is also built into its cost structure. I mean, what are some of the challenges in transferring this to the hospital?
Well, essentially what you want to start with is something like the Medicare allowable cost, which is a fairly standard way to calculate costs. And then if you want to pull out the disproportionate share kinds of activities and uncompensated care, if you want to pull out graduate medical education, you can do those things in fairly standard ways. But essentially, what you want to do is give the patient a sense at a DRG level, as opposed to what is normally done is giving information at an individual service by service. And most patients get on a cost, on a charge master file about 20,000 different items, none of which most of us can possibly understand. But what we do sort of kind of understand is that you're going to have an appendectomy, and that might be into a DRG, which they'll never really understand anyway. But the bundle of services, and our standard way that all hospitals understand is comparison of bundle of services. So that's where the hospital industry is moving, is towards bundle of services like a DRG, and then it's got the challenge of trying to translate what a DRG is to the American public.
Now, we don't have that on the physician side, right? I mean, there's no equivalent to a bundle of services that you get when you walk into a physician's office.
Well, I think it depends. I mean, major surgery has always had a 90-day global surgery period, so there is some bundling on the surgical side. We actually have a proposal for what we're calling a patient-centered medical home, which will be a model for chronic disease where physicians organize their practices to provide patient-centric services, involve self-management for patients, follow-up, evidence-based clinical decision support, and so forth. We are recommending actually pilot testing that with Medicare and other payers and paying a global fee for those patient-centered services. And those practices would also be accountable and transparent in the sense that to qualify for this different payment model, they would have to meet certain standards to show they could deliver patient-centered chronic disease services up front. And then they would report on quality of care measures for chronic disease, and once they're available, cost of care and patient experience measures. So the accountability both at the front end and the back end. So there's movement in that direction, and we think that model could have tremendous potential not only to introduce transparency, because you have this front-end information, does the practice qualify, plus the measurement at the back end, and paying them on a global fee for a lot of those services, but also it's oriented to that patient population I mentioned before who are chronic disease patients and are very expensive patients to take care of.
And Chuck, was there any, I mean, there's one can imagine many different goals in transparency, one being to sort of nudge the marketplace, nudge physicians, the other being to give patients some expectation of what they might have to pay when they walk into a doctor's office. We had a couple emails, one from a reporter in Buffalo about, you know, is there any way to bundle the services together to give patients that better sense of, okay, I walk in the office for X type of condition, what can I expect to pay? And is that something you all have looked at trying to do?
It is. And again, you know, we learn as we go. And again, I'll just give you one anecdote. The person at Aetna who is in charge of developing our consumer-directed plans got a statement of benefits in the mail. And fortunately, I think ours is more easily understandable. Because her husband said, gee, what is this $90 visit to the doctor? I thought a doctor visit was $10. So, you know, people have this sense that, you know, the copayment is what something costs. And what we were trying to do, in part, was to introduce a greater understanding of what things cost so that people have an appreciation for the services. And I think, actually, an appreciation for the physician, you know, I think it's worth more if people understand what it is, but it also, we hope, will drive more appropriate behavior. Now, having said that, I agree with Bob again that just understanding what an office visit costs won't tell somebody with diabetes what it's going to cost them for the year in order to be able to get their care. The challenge that we have there is how do we put all that together and attribution rules and all sorts of other, you know, important issues that we need to consider. If we can come up with other methodologies, especially payment methodologies, which allow us to do that more easily, you know, that's wonderful. The example, you know, that I gave you with Virginia Mason has led us to a kind of service pricing for the range of services that they provide in a bundle rather than for each individual service, which allows them to do it in a financially viable way and allows us to do it in a way which costs us less than it would have previously. So what I'm hoping is that more of these kinds of discussions will occur between physicians and hospitals and health plans so we can come up with a new strategy that will both be more transparent and also allow us to price more appropriately.
You talk about cost of care, too. It's not just the cost of the physician. Take the case of a diabetic, and if the physician can help that diabetic control their blood sugar, preventing complications that lead to amputation and hospital admission, right, there is a savings in terms of cost of care and certainly an improvement in the quality of life for that patient. So you're just measuring costs on the physician side without taking into account the impact on other parts of the healthcare economy and the other sectors like the hospital side. It's going to be misleading. So, again, it is very difficult because you have the whole attribution issue to show that what the physician is doing directly had an impact in terms of avoiding preventing a complication leading to hospitalization, which you may not know for 4 or 5 years on the road. But it's a very important part of this because if we really want to create a more efficient healthcare system, you need to find a way of taking that into account.
We could always globally capitate physicians, right? For
I was going to say that. We've been down that road.
and you could do that, but the question is, what Bob was suggesting is not only are they saving physician time, but they're also saving hospital time. So then do you take some money out of the hospital sector when they're able to be more efficient? How do you handle that? Because you've got them responsible for a lot of the expenditures, a lot of the prescription drugs, a lot of the hospital care, all those things. And certainly the specialty care if you're an internist. But at the same time, do you take money away from those other providers if the internist does a particularly good job? I mean, that's politically really hard to do and to essentially to establish that it's the internist who should get rewarded for all that good activity.
Right, or penalized on the other side.
Or penalized.
Well, I should say, in full disclosure, I'm an internist. So obviously, I think that the internist should be rewarded in some way. And in fact, internists are. If you look at the experiment in Bridges to Excellence, the longest experience right now is in Cincinnati and Louisville. And Bridges to Excellence is a program where physicians are paid $100 per patient in their practice if they have met the performance recognition requirements. And so the doctors who have met those requirements are actually being paid more. And the preliminary results that I've seen from Bridges to Excellence shows a net cost savings, in part for the reasons that you described. So it's not that we're taking money away, but because they're getting better care and they're avoiding complications, they're ending up in the emergency room less and they're ending up in the hospital less and they're having less unnecessary testing. So, I think there are some good examples that we could build on that would lead down that road.
Mm-hmm. And some of those, not all those. In fact, Bridges to Excellence is a good example where it's not necessarily based on disclosure or transparency, but simply a better structure for the system and, right, and better management relationships between plans and providers.
Which sort of leads to the question of who should pay for better quality. Is it what we've done in a lot of our pay-for-performance and other types of activities is ask doctors to take a withhold and then if they do better, they get it back or they maybe get a little bit more. But that's essentially asking doctors to pay for it. But if we believe, as we've been talking about now, that you essentially get fewer ambulatory care-sensitive conditions, fewer preventable hospitalizations, all sorts of things, maybe it's the insurer company that actually benefits from those things.
Or employers.
Or employers.
That's the case, maybe.
I think there are two ways to look at that. One is those employers who are participating in Cincinnati and Louisville and the other Bridges to Excellence activities are actually doing that as incremental payments. So it's not a withhold. It's incremental to what the doctors would have gotten. On the other hand, I'll tell you that I've had conversations with employers who said, why are we paying doctors to do something that they should have been doing as part of their base reimbursement? So,
part of the answer to that is that to do it well requires you have systems in place. Most of this is not, as IOM talks about, not human failure. It's not having systems. So when you talk about the diabetic patient, it's having the evidence-based guidelines at the point of care. It is having systems to follow up with them on a regular basis to make sure they're getting the foot exam, on a regular basis, all those kind of things. Those are system issues, and there is a cost to a practice of developing that infrastructure to do that well. And that's where the issues of reimbursement come in. To expect people to report on the measure without having the systems in place to deliver care consistent with what's being measured is really the real obstacle that has to be overcome, and there needs to be some funding for that.
I want to bring our audience back in here. We have another caller on the line, this time from here in Washington, D.C. Are you still there?
I am.
Yeah, go ahead.
This is Joel Finkelstein. I'm a Washington correspondent for AAFP News Now, and I have been covering the healthcare field long enough to wonder whether transparency, as good as that sounds and as popular a word as it is in Washington right now, isn't just another dead-end solution that we've seen before, like the managed care model or the gatekeeper models, which, you know, were sold to government and to the public, but never really addressed sort of the fundamental factors that are driving healthcare costs. So I'd like to ask the panel whether this is different than those previous panaceas, and if so, how?
Thanks for your question. Jerry, maybe I can start with you. Is this just this year's model?
Probably it's this year's model unless I sound like an academic here, but unless we get the methodology right. And right now, I think we're many years away from having the methodology right. I mean, you've heard us already just talking today for the past half hour about how difficult this activity is to do. And we at Johns Hopkins and a lot of other academic places are working on this, but trying to bundle services, trying to deal with somebody with multiple chronic conditions, dealing with multiple doctors, it gets the permutations and commutations of measuring accountability for price, for all the services that they do, for quality, is really, really hard.
And that's where the money is in the health system.
And that's where those are the people where the money is. Not all the people. Most of the people just have one thing wrong with them, or fortunately not anything wrong with them, but most of the dollars are in the multiple chronic conditions. And that's really hard to do, and we've been working on it for 20 years, and we're not even close.
And Chuck Heller, I mean, is this is just a fad, or is it you think we're here to stay for a while?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've been in managed care so long, I've been called both a communist and a capitalist. And so, you know, I see this, again, as an evolution. I think it's a step forward, and I don't think it's the solution, but I think it's part of the solution. And I agree with what Jerry said. We have to do it right. I would take exception to the premise, some of the other premises that the caller raised, though. I mean, I don't think managed care was a failure. If you look at the cost increases over time before the introduction of managed care, I think there's been a significant impact. If you look at various quality measures, if you look at the HEDIS measures, since HEDIS started, there are huge increases in the quality of care as measured by HEDIS. And lastly, you know, I think that while the gatekeeper model may have not been done right, I think what we're seeing in terms of the medical home and some of the things actually we've talked with the AAFP about is the need for a primary care physician who has a long-term relationship with patients and who will help them navigate the healthcare system effectively. And, you know, we should try to experiment with ways of making that viable and feasible for health plans and for physicians. But I don't think that I would give up on a primary care model by any stretch.
And indeed, Jerry had talked earlier when we started the conversation about that our focus had been on the quantity side of healthcare. Obviously, we've been talking a lot today about the price side. Has there been a backsliding on the quantity side in terms of cost since managed care started to lighten up a little bit?
You know, I think there has been a significant increase in quantity, but largely in areas that are new. So we're seeing, as Medicare reported as well, huge increases in the use of imaging, for example, in new technologies, some of which are duplicative and some of which may not be necessary. On the other hand, if you look at common things like the bed days per thousand that we see now compared to what we saw 20 years ago, I don't think there's any question that the hospital days are significantly less than they were previously. Length of stay for bypass surgery when I was a resident was 3 weeks, and now it's 5 days or 6 days. So, you know, I think that, and some of that was driven by DRGs providing incentives for hospitals to do things differently, and some by managed care. So I think in terms of appropriate utilization, that I think there have been huge improvements in appropriate utilization. among those things which are established. I think we're still struggling with new technologies and how best to use them.
Bob Dougherty, you spend your life here in Washington.
Yeah.
What's your sense of how this is viewed on the policy side?
Well, you know, I would not call it a panacea, and I think that's come through the discussion today. Transparency, whether it's pricing, quality, patient experience, or some combination, I think we're talking about some combination, is not by itself going to solve all the problems of chronic diseases, end-of-life care, all those kind of issues, not going to deal with the cost shifting that happens because we have such a large uninsured population, which I don't work for the hospitals. If you talk to them about their pricing structure, they'll talk about the cross-subsidization because there's so many indigent patients they take care of. There are huge problems, and if we expect that transparency by itself is going to solve all that, be the magic bullet, I think we're going to be disappointed. Having said that, I think it's here to stay. I think we are in a time where people expect to get information. You expect to get it when you're buying a car. You expect to get it whether you're buying a house. You expect to get it whether you're enrolling your kid in a summer camp. And I think that people are going to expect that they're going to be able to get information about the quality of care that their physicians and other healthcare professionals provide, as well as to the extent if we can overcome these hurdles, some reasonable measures of the cost of care.
So that's separate from what's going on in healthcare. That's just a byproduct.
I mean, I think that's the society we live in, and I don't see that turning back. And I think it's something they've done right. The healthcare professions will embrace if it's done right.
I think for me, the real challenge for the next 15 years or so is to see if prices actually go down in the healthcare sector. I mean, if you know, and what I see is the private sector not doing very much right now to bring prices down. So, again, I tend to focus more on hospitals than I do on physicians. But I look at the MedPAC reports, and Medicare's rate, if Medicare's rates is 100, the private sector right now is paying about 125, 130. Used to be only paying 110, 115. So for the last 5 years, the differential between what Medicare is paying hospitals and what the private sector is paying hospitals is growing. And if I'm looking for this price transparency and other things to bring prices down, I would expect them to go back down over the next 5 years. And so for me, the market test is the differential between what Medicare pays and what the private sector is paying for health care.
Chuck, I mean, as a health plan, how come you can't do that?
Well, I think the health plans would argue that Medicare's rate increases have been so minimal that they're cost shifting to the health plans. And the health plans and private employers are making up the difference. In addition to the growing uninsured, and the health plans and employers are making up those differences as well. So, you know, I think there certainly are a number of examples where if you look at individual services, by doing things more efficiently, by shifting things to the outpatient setting, that there are lower costs for those individual services. For other services which continue to be provided in the same setting, so deliveries in the hospital, for example, I think we're suffering from some of that cost shifting. And, you know, if Medicare continues to ratchet down its prices, I think it will continue to be challenging for the private sector.
But I still wonder why you're paying 30% more than the Medicare program is doing and why you feel that you need to do that.
Gee, I think we ask the hospitals that we contract with that question on a regular basis.
Right.
And you know there are a number of factors. One, Medicare, the uninsured consolidations in hospitals. I think we would say, many health plans would say that hospitals have a lot of negotiating leverage these days, and unless we and our employer clients are willing to walk away from some hospitals to get better negotiating leverage, it's going to be tough.
Right. And so that's where the price transparency, if it's going to work, is going to come in. By disclosing those prices, you may have greater leverage. And, you know, so for me, that's the market test of whether this price transparency will in fact work. And where I would see it working mostly is in the private sector, because as you say, Medicare sets the rates anyway.
Jerry, I'm going to ask you not to put you on the spot too much, but you've been studying this for a long time. What if we were going to focus on price, your God for a moment, in the U.S., what is the best approach?
Well, essentially, what I think is something like what Medicare does. I mean, if you is a rate that essentially is fully disclosed to everyone and is based upon, is to the extent we can, a bundled group of services. So for me, that's the simple answer.
Now, I think on the physician side, I mean, linking it in some way to the resource-based relative value scale for Medicare does make sense, because at least there is a process to establish relative values, and actually the price paid for a lot of procedures did come down, at least initially, when that system was folded in. There are some reasons that has stalled in recent years, and some efforts to change that. So I think pegging some way of price sensitivity to that relative value scale, I think makes sense on the physician side. Again, if we're just dealing with the price side.
Well, you know, I think that this is part of a multi-pronged strategy. We need to have transparency so consumers understand what they're paying. We need to have measures of quality and experience with care so that consumers have more complete information. We need to engage physicians and hospitals in looking at what they do so they could be more efficient over time. So all of, and we need to have ways of rewarding those people who do better, like pay for performance. So I see this as one important component, a consumer-directed component, but only part of the picture.
And let me ask you, we're coming to the end of the hour, just to return to transparency now as we're coming to a close. As you roll out these efforts, and first question is, do you anticipate expanding this beyond the communities that you're going to next month?
Again, we do. With each new experience, we learn some more things, and we'll make some tweaks, so it may not be exactly the same in all communities. We'd like to share more complete information, more quality information, and efficiency information. But yes, our plan is to do this in a kind of progressive way, so that this is the next a group that we'll be making public, and that we'll make more public after that.
And what will you be looking at to track assess the effects and track the...
Well, some of the things that we've talked about earlier today, one is the information accessible to most people? Do they understand it, and do they find it valuable? Are people using it?
Have you done surveys or consumer focus groups?
We did focus groups both before and after the experience in Cincinnati, but that's one market, so relatively small exposure. We've done some work since then about what we're going to show with the next iteration. But again, you know, it's like any sort of testing. You may get a small amount of information from a focus group of 10 people as we roll this out and we get more experience and do more surveys and we ask for feedback on our website, then we'll get more information and we'll fine-tune it.
And what ultimately would be your measure of success? If you had to pick two or three things, looking back, how would you decide whether it's successful or not?
Well, you know, I think what we'd want is people to make informed decisions about where to get their care. And that doesn't always mean choosing the lowest price. It may be that they're choosing a physician based on a lot of reasons, but understanding the price is important to them. So the transparency piece, even though we're only talking about cost today because that's what's available, we hope by having more information like quality and experience with care information will allow people really to make an informed choice about the value that they're getting from their health care.
Bob Daugherty, we talked a little bit about what's going on in Washington. You've had conversations with the administration,
right,
on their transparency initiatives. What next 6 months to a year, what should we look out for, whether it's legislation?
Well, CMS is moving forward on doing things it can do under its current authority to disclose pricing. There's actually the Health Information Technology Bill that's supposed to go to the floor of the House tomorrow. I heard that there's going to be something in there about hospital pricing, which I understand is being opposed by the hospital lobby. But so you're starting to see Congress step in. But I still think a lot of the action is going to be in the private sector. I think you're going to see medicine continue to work with employers and health plans to develop good evidence-based quality measures. Once you have the quality measures in place, then I think the next logical evolution is to figure out, how do we measure cost? That is, how do you drive people towards physicians that provide consistently high-quality care but are judicious in their use of resources? And that's really, really where you need to end up. But I think you start with the quality measures, because really you're trying to drive people principally based on quality. Also, we do believe good quality often will result in cost savings and certainly better patient satisfaction with the care they get.
And on the quality side, from your perspective, what should the administration, CMS, Congress be doing to nudge that along?
Well, we're actually testifying before the House Energy and Commerce Committee Thursday, and we are supporting moving forward our Medicare pay-for-reporting program as early as next year. for ambulatory care, there are 26 measures that have already been approved by the Ambulatory Care Quality Alliance, and we would support moving forward on a voluntary basis initially with a reporting program where there is some link to payment for physicians to report on those measures.
Jerry, you get the last word here. As the academic in the room, how should we be looking at these transparency efforts and measuring or assessing their
effects? Well, I think it's all that we have talked about. But for me, if you're looking for one thing, it's do prices go down? I mean, the prices are very high in the United States compared to other countries. The private sector in the United States is paying higher prices than the public sector is paying for services. If this activity is going to have an impact, it's going to drive the prices down, and I think it's got to drive the high-cost providers' prices down. It does it in one of two ways. Either people stop going there, or those providers say, yes, we're just substantially more expensive, and we can lower our prices in order to be competitive with the other providers.
Great. I'm Larry Levitt. You've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. Thanks to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. We'll see you next time for Ask the Experts.